This is 5 o'clock shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network. Today, we have a breaking update on U.S. military developments regarding Afghanistan with policy analyst Robert Naiman of JustForeignPolicy.org. The latest developments in the court-martial of alleged WikiLeaks cable whistleblower Private Bradley Manning with Jeff Patterson of the BradleyManning.org project, and an encounter with Occupy California activist Emmanuel Seferios of the OccupyCards.com collective, which is releasing a new set of Occupy trading cards cataloging the issues and the motives behind the movement. This is 5 o'clock shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network, originating at WBAI. I'm Robert Knight in New York, and we're about to be joined live by Robert Naiman of JustForeignPolicy.org. Just 48 hours ago, we discussed the latest massacre of Afghan civilians by U.S. Staff Sergeant, and since that conversation, a number of significant events have occurred. Among them, the accused sergeant shooter was spirited out of Afghanistan overnight, obviating Afghan demands for a local and transparent murder trial for the 16 victims, nine of whom were children. The Pentagon claims that the U.S. occupation army did not have an adequate in-country stockade for the suspect. Number two, Defense Secretary Leon Panetta, fresh from telling Congress that he and President Obama did not need their legislative approval for foreign military hostilities, sneaked into Kabul overnight for urgent talks with the U.S.-installed President Hamid Karzai after Panetta's plane was sequestered at a British-American base when a stolen supply truck driven by an Afghani local rushed the runway and burst into flames. Panetta later addressed U.S. troops who were disarmed before being allowed near their defense secretary. And number three, Panetta claimed that he and Karzai discussed what is erroneously being called a potential U.S. military withdrawal from Afghanistan in 2013 instead of 2014. We're now joined live by Robert Naiman of JustForeignPolicy.org. Welcome back, Robert, and thanks for joining us at this special time. We know you're quite busy with urgent meetings on these and other developments with Just Foreign Policy, but for right now, what do you make of the latest maneuvers in Kabul and Washington?
Clearly, the U.S. is trying to bring about some change in the situation that they can show the American people and the world indicates that the whole thing is not unraveling. We've had three extreme incidents in the last 3 months, killings on Sunday, the Quran burning incident last month, and the corpse desecration video on Sunday. And those aren't the only difficulties. The U.S. has been trying to negotiate this long-term partnership agreement with the Afghan government. That agreement has been stalled as the Afghan government was demanding transfer of authority over prisoners into U.S. detentions and also an end to the U.S. night raids. And particularly the night raids issue is totally unresolved. Meanwhile, the Taliban talks seem to have been suspended by the Taliban, who claim that the U.S. isn't following through on the plans for a prisoner exchange. So that's all the bad things that are going on in Afghanistan. The domestic political front, for the first time, Republican voters seem to be split about 50-50 on the war, with half of Republicans saying it's not worth it, and we're seeing that reflected among Republican politicians, with both Newt Gingrich and Rick Santorum recently saying maybe it's time to get out. So on a number of fronts, the administration is facing a challenge on its policy.
Robert, one of the things that we have discussed here is the falsity of the claim that what is being discussed is a U.S. military withdrawal from Afghanistan. And we've seen before in Iraq, where the remaining combatants of the United States Armed Forces are simply redubbed as trainers instead of, quote, combat troops, end quote. And I'd like for you to once again reiterate the point about the so-called withdrawal does not really mean withdrawal. And where have you most prominently seen this policy lie being told?
Well, first of all, I think it's crucial for Americans to understand that in 2008, there was an agreement between the U.S. government and the Iraqi government that had a timetable for the withdrawal of all U.S. armed forces, all U.S. uniformed troops, and all Department of Defense contractors by December 31st, 2011. That was the agreement that was implemented at the end of last year. And essentially all U.S. armed forces are, no, special forces, CIA, private contractors, that's something different. But all uniformed U.S. troops are out of Iraq. There's obviously a lot you can say about, you know, what's really, you know, what else is going on. But all uniformed U.S. troops are out of Iraq. There is no such agreement in the case of Afghanistan. There's no agreement between the U.S. in the Afghan government for the withdrawal of all U.S. forces. There's no agreement in NATO for the withdrawal of all foreign forces. There's a goal that was agreed at the NATO summit for transition to Afghan responsibility for security by 2014. You're absolutely right that there is, you know, at best, a fuzzy gray line between combat and training, and we saw that in Iraq when we were told that the combat mission was over. No, I'm not talking about what happened last year. I'm talking about earlier. We were told that the combat mission was over and there were no U.S. combat troops. And the troops that were there were renamed from combat to trainers. And their explanation for that as well, you know, to train them, you have to go with them. So it's sort of hands-on, it's practicum training. And that's what they have in mind for Afghanistan in the future, that there would be 20, even after 2014, there would be 20,000, 25,000 U.S. troops there. There would be in an advisory support training role. And, you know, the thing that other people care about is, are they killing and dying? You know, are they engaged in combat, whether you call them combat or trainers? So there is no plan, as of now, there is no agreed plan for the withdrawal of U.S. forces in Afghanistan, unlike the situation in Iraq after 2008. And that is often regularly misreported in the press, particularly New York Times, but other press, saying that all foreign forces or all U.S. forces are supposed to be out by 2014. It's great that people have that expectation, but unless there is a change in direction, that expectation will not be met. That's certainly not the goal of the Pentagon. The Pentagon has a very different goal. The goal of the Pentagon is to keep tens of thousands of U.S. armed troops in Afghanistan after 2014. They had that goal in Iraq, too, but they were defeated in that goal in Iraq. But they're determined to carry through that goal in Afghanistan. That's not what the majority of the American people want. The majority of American people, according to opinion poll, want U.S. forces withdrawn from Afghanistan on a much quicker timetable than even the president has announced and the media has reported, let alone what the Pentagon wants to do, which is completely the opposite of what the majority of
Given the vagaries of American politics, rhetoric, and propaganda, this is certainly going to be an issue in the next round of elections in the United States. And it seems that the submission to public relations means that candidates of either or all parties will do whatever is necessary to attempt to win an election. You've got a situation where now some Republicans are saying they don't want to be in Afghanistan, even though they said they wanted to be several years ago. Do you see any possibility that the military-industrial complex will attempt to maintain a presence in Afghanistan well beyond 2014, and perhaps because of the relationship of presidential elections to foreign policy, till 2016, when Hillary Clinton is making her second presidential bid?
Well, there's no question in my mind that if it were up to the Pentagon, there would be U.S. troops in Afghanistan indefinitely. But the Pentagon wants what they wanted in Iraq, that it's a permanent U.S. military garrison. Now, they get around this by saying that, you know, oh, we don't have any plans for permanent U.S. bases. They're going to be Afghan bases, but they're going to have U.S. soldiers on them permanently. Won't be the same soldiers. They'll, you know, rotate new soldiers in. But there will be, if it's up to the Pentagon, there will be a permanent U.S. military presence in Afghanistan. Of course, that's a recipe for continued conflict, because the main demand of the insurgents in Afghanistan is for a timetable for the withdrawal of all U.S. foreign forces. So if it's up to the Pentagon, you know, 2016, 2024, if it's up to the Pentagon. But, of course, it's not totally up to the Pentagon. The Pentagon didn't get what it wanted in Iraq, and so it's not a law of the universe that the Pentagon has to get what it wants in Afghanistan.
One other issue about a possible disengagement of U.S. command and control in Afghanistan is the fact that the regime of Hamid Karzai is something of a paper tiger. It controls only a small part of the country. And do you envision, if the backup of military forces from the United States, NATO, and elsewhere is not there for security, that we could see a collapse of the Karzai regime and then a pathway towards a more organic indigenous social arrangement inside Afghanistan?
Well, you're certainly right. The first part is easy. You know, Karzai has often been derided as the mayor of Kabul, and the Afghan government doesn't have effective control over much of the country, neither the U.S. troops. What happens as U.S. forces withdraw, I think this depends a lot on the Afghans and the political process. The there is a longstanding civil war in Afghanistan that goes back 30 years, and it predates the U.S. intervention on one side of the civil war. And, you know, there's different scenarios of what might happen. There might be a kind of de facto partition of the country in the sense that, you know, there might be a nominal central government in Kabul, but a lot of devolution of power to the locals, and you see people that are politically close to the Taliban in the rural Pashtun South, and people that are politically close to the Northern Alliance in the north. Or it's possible that there could be some kind of political settlement to share power. It can be easy, but it's a possibility. I think what we know for sure is that U.S. efforts to impose the current centralized government on the country have failed and will likely continue to fail. And, you know, it's often said, and people point out, that Afghanistan doesn't have a tradition of centralized central government, but powerful central government. But what people don't often know is that the model that was imposed on Afghanistan after 2001 is not only foreign to Afghanistan, but it's foreign to the United States. Under the present Afghan constitution sponsored by the U.S. in 2001, the president appoints local governors. That's more centralization than we even have in the U.S. That's like French kind of centralization. So in a country that's not used to, you know, many areas of Afghanistan, local people see the government, the Kabul government, as foreign as they see the American. On that kind of society, we have this extremely highly central government imposed. That is not sustainable. There has to be a devolution one way or another. There has to be and there will be a devolution of.
In the United States, we call it states' rights. There, it might be called jirga rights in terms of the different organizations of the tribal, social, and religious structure there, with the clan input and so many other things. It is really incomprehensible how American might seek to impose an order on a society such as that. I know that you're very busy with meetings, Robert. One final question in the remaining 2 or 3 minutes for you. And that is the relationship to Pakistan and the region. Pakistan, at least temporarily, has closed ground supply routes to Afghanistan for the United States. As a result, the Pentagon, which is the biggest single spender of carbon gases through the fuels that are used to transport equipment and troops, the Pentagon, the largest single burner on Earth, is now having to spend more, waste more energy to maintain the presence in Afghanistan through bases like in Kyrgyzstan and on the northern tier. Do you see a possibility where the cost of this involvement, this multi-trillion dollar cost of occupying Afghanistan and anywhere nearby, could become so great that it would be finance more than politics that brings it to an end, sort of like the plot twist in the movie THX 1138?
Well, I think the two things go together. You know, when the cost of the war is huge, and you're right that the part of the reason the cost of the war is huge is that the logistics are relatively more costly because so much has to be done by flying, and the supply lines are so long. But of course, that goes hand in hand. You know, World War II was costly, but people believe in it. So when people look at the mounting cost and they ask, you know, what are we getting out of this? We're coming up on the anniversary of the killing of Osama bin Laden. People are saying, you know, why are we still there? What are we doing there? And so, yes, absolutely. And, of course, we're at a time in the United States where there's a lot of belief that, you know, we need to cut the budget. It's a very attractive place to cut the budget, a huge expenditure for which we're not getting anything, and in fact, you know, causing harm both to the people of Afghanistan and to our own troops. And, you know, these incidents involving U.S. soldiers, I think, should remind us not only what we're doing to the people of Afghanistan, but, of course, the toll that 10 years of war has taken on the armed forces. The accused suspect in the killings on Sunday, it was his fourth deployment. He'd been deployed to Iraq three times. He had a head injury there. He came from a military base in the U.S. where there's been a lot of...
Sure, and there's not only the U.S. assaults against Afghan citizens, but also inter-troop violence and suppression and discrimination, as well as that between the Americans and their Afghan trainees, the Barty Fifes, as it were, who are not allowed to carry weapons in the same way that the U.S. troops are allowed to do. Robert Naiman, thank you so much for joining us. I know you're busy doing your rapid response on these and other issues at justforeignpolicy.org, and I recommend that our listeners visit the website and keep track of your work. You're on Huffington and elsewhere, and I thank you for taking this time out for these breaking events today.
Good to speak with you.
All right, we'll continue. See you soon. Coming up in the program today, we'll have the latest on the court-martial of Private First Class Bradley Manning, as well as a look at what is being done through California with the Occupy movement and a new set of teaching aids that are coming to us. This is 5 o'clock Shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network. I'm Robert Knight in New York, and we turn now to the plight of accused whistleblower Bradley Manning, who's accused of leaking State Department cables to the investigative news and website WikiLeaks. As of the latest developments, the defense has filed a motion to dismiss the charges with prejudice against Bradley Manning after concluding that the government violated his rights by failing to disclose evidence under the Brady Rule, mandating that. The defense said that the government was denying him the right to a fair trial or court-martial. The prosecution said that the rule, as they understood it, means that they only have to disclose unclassified material. To help clarify and bring us up to date on the latest developments in the saga of Private Bradley Manning, we're joined by Jeff Patterson. He's with BradleyManning.org. Welcome back, Jeff. What is the latest today and in the overall conduct of the case?
Well, as you mentioned, today there was a hearing at Fort Meade where David Coombs, the attorney provided to Bradley Manning by the Bradley Manning Support Network, is arguing for a dismissal of the charges against him with prejudice based on the government simply refusing to turn over turn over the evidence that David Coombs has been fighting for over a year and a half now. The government claims that they don't have to because the evidence is classified. Well, that's not surprising because everything we're talking about in this case, the collateral murder video, the State Department cables that have embarrassed the U.S. foreign policy, the documents from the Iraq and Afghan battlefields, they're all still technically classified, and yet they're freely available to anybody on the internet. So every aspect of this case is quote classified and yet freely available at the same time, and yet the government is continuing to use this imaginary classified secret situation to deprive Bradley of a fair trial. Bradley was supposed to have a speedy trial within 120 days of arrest. We are now at 650 days that Bradley has been subjected to pretrial confinement at Quantico Marine Corps Base when he was first returned stateside from Iraq. He was subjected to 10 months of torturous conditions, and the United Nations is still trying to meet with Bradley Manning to hold the U.S. military accountable to their illegal punishment of Bradley in those conditions. So that's one of many things that are unfolding. And now we're at the time where he has not got a speedy trial. The government is refusing to turn over the evidence. The government continues to claim that Bradley somehow aided the enemy in some abstract way, that providing information into the public domain for the public good somehow aided our enemies. And it's simply not true, and they have been unable to show any harm to any person or specific policy of the United States because of this. And yet the benefits of this information being in the public sphere has helped a wave of democratic revolutions.
That addresses the claim made by the prosecution that the release aided al-Qaeda in some way. I'm taken by the argument that was made by defense attorney David Coombs, who used the MacArthur Park metaphor. He said that the prosecution's failure to disclose evidence was like a baker baking a 45-minute cake, but 40 minutes into the baking realizes that he or she left out the eggs and then says, well, I'm just going to take the cake back out and put the eggs in. And so, in effect, the defense is arguing that with the sequestration of the evidence and the exculpatory evidence that may be available otherwise, that, in other words, the Pentagon left the cake out in the rain. Do you think that the dismissal motion will carry weight on that basis?
We're talking about a military court-martial in front of a military judge. Of course, everything we're doing, we hope will succeed, but we're not under the illusion that that it will. This case is going to go to a court-martial. We have constitutional issues that have arisen in this case already, and I expect these constitutional issues could be, reviewed by the federal courts and by different circuit judges at some point down the road. We have President Obama in Bradley's chain of command engaging in unlawful command influence towards the outcome. He's already declared him, Bradley Manning, guilty. We have Secretary of Joint Chief of Staff last week declaring Bradley Manning guilty, all clearly illegal under the Uniform Code of Military Justice, and have already deprived Bradley's due process rights. We're in this. We're going to be fighting tooth and nail to give Bradley every chance. But unless we have public opinion on our side, that's the only thing that's going to extract some measure of justice out of a military, quote-unquote, justice system that's far more interested in disciplining soldiers than providing justice.
Well, there's another odd thing about this case and the information surrounding it, and I'm stunned by this development. Maybe you can help us understand it, Jeff Patterson. Apparently, the prosecution and the federal government, the Pentagon and all, have mangled the case by missing messages because when the WikiLeaks cables were released, all government computers were instructed not to approach or carry the content. of the WikiLeaks. And as a result, the prosecution and the judge and others missed emails, important emails, among each other because of this brute force lockdown of government computers. According to Captain Ashton Fine, he said that the messages were, quote, blocked by a spam filter for security, end quote, because the Obama administration did not want government employees reading what everybody else in the world was reading. Are you aware of that? And does that increase the sense of surrealism about this prosecution?
We learned today that that is one of the government's excuses for having not turned over evidence in this case. David Coombs has been requesting information, obviously, regarding WikiLeaks. He has records of those those documents being sent to the prosecution and to the judge in this case. And they were literally ignored, and his follow-up emails were ignored. And today we learned that the prosecution is claiming that they simply did not receive his request for evidence because of a spam filter. So yes, it's obviously ridiculous, but that's today's excuse. And, you know, it may have some basis in fact.
Well, final question for you, Jeff, is this. The WikiLeaks website and organization is continuing to bring forward important material, not only the collateral murder video and the treasure trove of U.S. foreign policy at work through the State Department cables, and now new material from the privatized intelligence firm called Stratfor, and those releases are ongoing. Can you finally put into context for us the public good that is done by a technical violation of the release of information?
That is what we're arguing here. It's that Bradley Manning is a whistleblower in every sense of the word, as much so as Dan Ellsberg was when he released thousands of pages of top-secret documents, the Pentagon Papers that helped end the Vietnam War. Here is Bradley Manning, who released these battlefield reports from the ground in Iraq that showed U.S. troops and documenting tens of thousands of civilian casualties due to coalition forces that were never counted before. And President Obama wanted to extend the service agreement in Iraq and have U.S. troops stay beyond New Year. And it was because of these documents being in the public realm, being available to Iraqis and opposition Iraqi lawmakers, that the extension of that agreement could not be found. And U.S. troops had to pull out. Bradley Manning, a private first class in the Army, had a direct impact on making President Obama play his hand and remove troops from Iraq. And there is an obvious connection there into history with Daniel Ellsberg and the Pentagon Papers. Now, today, in hindsight, everybody believes Daniel Ellsberg is a hero for the most part. You know, a documentary nominated for an Academy Award and whatnot, and he never spent the day in jail. And yet here's Bradley Manning today, facing the real possibility of life in prison for releasing documents that included war crimes, that included information that we need as a population within a democracy to hold our government accountable for what's happening with our tax dollars in our names, and helping end a very unpopular war. And yet this young man has been in prison for 2 years and literally is facing life in prison at an upcoming court-martial. It's outrageous.
Well, I thank you for the clarity on the prosecution of Bradley Manning today, Jeff Patterson. You're with bradleymanning.org. What might people find there, and why should they visit the site?
We have a team of people are dedicated. We're fighting on this, and we're going to fight to the end on this. Every day you'll see new articles, new analysis of the campaign, organizers around the world posting what they're doing. And people can get involved. People could donate to the Defense Fund and follow the case day in and day out. And, we're going to be here until Bradley's free.
Well, thank you so much, Jeff Patterson, bradleymanning.org. This is 5 O'Clock Shadow. I'm Robert Knight in New York. And we now move to some of the latest developments in the Occupy movement. We are joined live in studio by Emmanuel Sfirios. He's a member of the OccuCards.com collective, about which we'll have much to say about their new educational product. I call them trading cards, but they look like postcards. And boy, are they deep. And four-color glossy printed and very, very attractive as well as educational. And Emmanuel comes to us on a temporary visit to New York from the Occupy movement in California's Grass Valley, pardon the expression.
Well, we do have an economy focusing on that, but I don't think the name came about for that reason.
Temporarily Humboldt County. Activities in California. Can you first just give us some idea about the bridge between the two coasts and the continuity of the Occupy movements here, there, and elsewhere?
Well, I think one of the great things about the Occupy movement is that it is so diverse, and groups in different cities are doing very different things. I mean, the gap between, say, Oakland and New York isn't probably as great as the gap between Oakland and Grass Valley, which is only 2.5 hours away. And by gap, I don't mean any kind of conflict. I just mean, you know, we're very different. We're a small rural county, Nevada County in Northern California. And so we have a very different dynamic, different issues, than a big city like Oakland has. But one of the things we were trying to do, you know, because our collective is based in Grass Valley, even though we do have New York and Oakland members, is put out educational literature for the movement as a whole, for Occupy groups everywhere. Outreach literature. We call them OccuCards, and we've picked 10 to start, which we felt, you know, sort of embodied the heart of the movement, right? Two banks, four issues with the National Defense Authorization Act, one piece of legislation, had to throw Monsanto in there, of course.
Well, let's get right to that. I'm going to anti-seriatim go through some of the releases. Wells Fargo, Climate Change, the Prison Industrial Complex, Monsanto, as you mentioned, NDAA, the National Defense Authorization Act, the Monetary System, the Military Industrial Complex, Healthcare, Corporate Personhood, and, of course, Goldman Sachs. And these cards are glossy printed on both sides. It's a series called Why We Occupy, Exposing and Opposing the Corporate State. Well, and each one of them has the optical checkerboard for digital scanning.
Yeah, those are called QR codes. You can use your smartphone and scan it, go directly to that page for that topic on the website.
How clever.
Has more information and references and external links for educating yourself more.
What is the genesis of this project? How, I would say who wrote it, but knowing the nature of the Occupy movement, I think I'd could better phrase it as say, how did it get written, the précis of these issues on the on the obverse, reverse side of these cards?
Let me say a lot of research went into writing each of these cards, and we have a pretty complex editorial process with about four major editors who went through and fact-checked, and we vetted them through a lot of people who even aren't officially a part of our collective, getting people's opinions, hearing what they have to say. You know, the idea is to present these concepts, these facts, to the general population so that they understand why we have a movement of education, protest, and civil disobedience. Most of the cards end with a call for building a mass movement of education, protest, and civil disobedience. And this is one of the things we want to encourage readers of these cards to do. Say, hey, this is why people are a part of this movement, and I should join it too, because look at how screwed up everything is. So.
Well, in about 20 square inches, you have more information than a newspaper for somebody riding on the subway.
We had to make these cards very dense. We believe that anyone with a high school education can easily understand them, but perhaps they lean more towards a college education. But the problem is to fit that much information on a 4x6 index card. You have to be very dense in your writing. In other words, put two clauses together in one sentence rather than having two sentences. So, there's a lot of which, blah, blah, blah. But you know, we think they're very hard-hitting. We think they cover, you know, the main topics on Goldman Sachs. You know, we just had this whistleblower, Greg Smith, yesterday, who talked about exactly the stuff that we, you know, wrote about. Not everyone knew it. We didn't need a whistleblower. You know, we may have an investigation now simply because there is a whistleblower. But, you know, this securities fraud and what they were doing, you know, we've known about for a while.
As for the writing style and compression, I like to quote Strunk and White. They're famous for their style manual for saying eliminate needless words, but seems to me they should have just said eliminate.
Yeah, they are like sutras. Mm-hmm. You know, I was, of course, a major part of the editorial group that wrote them. Mm-hmm. And I remember thinking, wow, yeah, you know, so you're trying to really condense things into a small space.
Who do you see reading these? Where would they be distributed and to whom with the greatest need and perhaps ability to respond upon reading them?
So we're trying to approach Occupy groups first, and we these are available on our website, the high-resolution PDFs, so that anyone can download them, take them to their local printer, and have them printed themselves. We, of course, encourage people to use union print shops. Mm-hmm. And you know, try to get cardstock if you can, because they're more durable. These aren't meant to be throwaway flyers. They're really meant for people to keep and pass around.
So that's interesting. That seems consistent with the ethos that I've perceived so far of the Occupy movement. It's an analog of the GNU General Usability License.
Right, exactly. Now, we also do have a copyright on them for the sole purpose of preventing people from putting out fake versions or altering the text, because we know the corporate state has in the past used various dirty tricks to tarnish a reputation of activists and destroy movements. So, you know, freely print, distribute them, but don't change anything.
One of the hallmarks of the Occupy movement has been almost zen-like, ineffable evolution of the issues, platforms, and principles, and such. It certainly has worked to the movement's benefit when clueless commentators say, well, who are these people and what do they want? So I'm wondering, in the production of these cards, what kind of interface was there with Occupy people in order that their content be consistent with the meaning of the movement?
Well, I can tell you that we have members in Occupy Wall Street here in New York, in Oakland, San Francisco, and Berkeley, as well as Grass Valley, and also people in St. Petersburg, Florida, and Tampa, Florida, because I happen to be from there. So I was actually there for family-related stuff when Occupy first formed. It was a shock to see my hometown of St. Pete, Florida, have 500 people come out for an Occupy event. There was no activism there when I was growing up. So we got input from a great many people within the Occupy movement, and even the topics we selected have been, we think, the topics that have been the most tweeted and Facebook posted about in the movement currently. But we're planning on producing quite a few more cards. We're, you know, taking input from people. We've already received dozens of emails from people since we launched about a week ago on our website, OccuCards.com.
OccuCards.com.
That is correct. Yep. So people love them, and they're recommending, you know, other new topics that we can write about. And certainly, this doesn't encompass them all. And we're hoping to, you know, raise funds to keep producing more.
In the minute or so that we have left, we're speaking with Emmanuel Sverios, and welcome to New York.
Thank you.
And how are you liking it? How's the interface with the folks here going?
Great. Well, I'm going to my first WGS tonight, right after I leave here. Then I'm actually going to the Left Forum to distribute thousands of these cards there this weekend. But I have met some new folks in Occupy. They all seem really great. It was kind of cold today, so there weren't that many people in Zuccotti Park. But I'll be here for a week, and I'm looking forward to meeting more.
Well, thanks and welcome once again. And this is a fine project. I'm aware of the history of baseball cards and trading cards as tools of education and documentation.
Do you remember the Friendly Dictator trading cards in the 80s?
I damn well do, because my partner, Dennis Bernstein, and I were... Dennis was the author. We were co-progenitors of that project.
Oh, great.
And so you're very astute. Certainly, I approve of this tradition and urge people to see and learn the OccuCards.com collective, the flashcards, Why We Occupy, a series of cards. Congratulations, this is a fine piece of work.
Thank
Emmanuel
you.
Sferios. And this is 5 O'Clock Shadow. Today's program was presented live and engineered by Michael G. Haskins and produced by Thiago Barroso. We welcome your comments, queries, suggestions, and tips and leaks with an email to theshadow, theshadow, at wbai.org. And for welcome, 5 O'Clock Shadow, I'm Robert Knight.
America, welcome South Florida to the life of the 99%. If you're part of that 99% that's hustling, struggling, and treading water, this song is about you. If you're part of the 1% that's not, this is for you to listen to. LaGuardia, let's talk about it.
We are the 99% trying to find the right amount of rent beneath the monument of falling stocks and pocket lint. Our outfits ain't got that fine designer scent. They got that overdrawn college loan kind of stench.
We are the 99%, 99, 99. And there's a 99% chance you are too occupied. Get in line.
99%, this clinch, vision, focus. Feeling overlooked, only eviction notice. Older folks convince the kids it isn't hopeless. It's easier to cope with when you keep their hope lit. We are the 99%. Used cars and credit card limits. Share a room with in-laws in it, but would much rather trade and put some dog paws in it. Some starve and some start a business, while some scar and some fall finished.
You're the 99%, 99, 99, 99.
And there's a 99% chance you are too occupied. You're the 99%. Put away the violin, put away the violins. Can't stay silent. 1% drives on a man-made island, while the other 99 pays the mileage. A former chef trying to look calm as usual. Found 99 ways to cook ramen noodles. A war vet fights to keep a job. It's brutal. There's people marching on the street. Man, look it up on Google. We are the 99% that the 1% keeps calling lazy. Even though we are the ones that be raising the 1%, baby. We are the 99%, 99, 99. If there's a 99% chance you are too occupied, get in line. We are the 99%, 99, 99. If there's a 99% chance you are too occupied, get in line.